speed, which made the music sound as if the entire orchestra had suddenly been overcome with nausea, as if someone had poisoned the players. Oh, how I adore music! I flopped limply round the room, sagging with the slowing music like a doll whose sawdust stuffing is pouring out, until the gramophone spring ran all the way down and I collapsed on the floor in a boneless heap. I hope you haven't been getting underfoot, Feely said. Remember what Father told us. I let my tongue crawl slowly out of my mouth like an earthworm emerging after a rain. But it was a wasted effort. Feely didn't take her eyes from the sheet of paper she was studying. Is that your part? I asked. As a matter of fact, it is. Let's have a deco. No, it's none of your business. Come on, Feely. I arranged it. If you get paid, I want half. Daffy inserted a finger in Bleak House to mark her place. NBGOOF. A maid places a letter on the table, she said in a matter-of-fact tone. That's all? I asked. That's it. But what does it mean? It means that in the background, out of focus, a maid places a letter on the table, just as it says. Feely was pretending to be preoccupied, but I could tell by the rising colour of her throat that she was listening. My sister Ophelia is like one of those exotic frogs whose skin changes colour involuntarily as a warning. In the frog, it's trying to make you think that it's poisonous. It's much the same in Feely. Carumba, I said. You'll be famous, Feely. Don't say carumba, she snapped. You know Father doesn't like it. He'll be home this morning, I reminded her, with Aunt Felicity. At that, a general glumness fell over the table, and we finished our breakfasts in stony silence. The down train from London was due at Doddingsley at 10:05. If Clarence Mundy had been picking them up in his taxicab, Father and Aunt Felicity would be at Buckshaw within half an hour. But today, allowing for the snow and the practice funereal pace at which the vicar usually drove, it seemed likely to be well past 11 before they arrived. It was, in fact, not until 1:15 that the vicar's Morris pulled up exhausted at the front door, piled like a refugee's cart with various peculiarly shaped objects projecting from the windows and lashed to the roof. As soon as they climbed out of the car, I could tell that Father and Aunt Felicity had been quarrelling. "For heaven's sake, Haviland," she was saying. "Anyone who can't tell a chaffinch from a brambling ought not to be allowed to look out the window of a railway carriage." "I'm quite sure it was a brambling, Lissy. It had the distinctive..." "Nonsense! Bring my bag, Denwin. The one with the large brass padlock." The vicar seemed a bit surprised to be ordered about in such an off-handed manner, but he pulled the carpet bag from the back seat of the car and handed it to Dogger. "Clever of you to think of winter tires and chains," Aunt Felicity said. "Most ecclesiastics are dead washouts when it comes to motor cars." I wanted to tell her about the bishop, but I kept quiet. Aunt Felicity bore down on the front door in her usual bulldog manner. Beneath her full-length motoring coat, I knew, she would be wearing her complete Victorian explorer's regalia, two-piece Norfolk jacket and skirt, with extra pockets sewn in for scissors, pens, pins, knife, and fork. She travelled with her own. "You never know who's eaten with what strange cutlery," she was fond of telling us. Several lengths of string, assorted elastics, a gadget for cutting the ends off cigars, and a small glass travelling container of gentleman's relish. "You can't find it since the war." "You see," she said, stepping into the foyer and taking in the jungle of motion picture equipment at a glance. "It's just as I told you. The cine moguls have their hearts set on laying waste to every noble home in England. The communists to the last man, Jack. Who do they make their pictures for? The people? As if the people are the only ones who need entertaining. It's enough to make the heavenly host bring up their manner." I was glad she hadn't said God, as that would have been blasphemous. "Morning, Lissy," someone called out. "Trying to go straight, are you?" It was Ted, The same electrician Desmond Duncan had spoken to. He was occupied on a scaffold with an enormous light. Aunt Felicity stifled an enormous sneeze, rummaging in her purse for a handkerchief.
"Aunt Felicity," I asked incredulously, "do you know that man?"
"Ran into him somewhere during the war. Some people never forget a name or a face, you know. Quite remarkable. In the blackout, I dare say."
Father pretended he hadn't heard and made straight for his study. "If it was in the blackout," I asked, "how could he see your face?"
"Impertinent children ought to be given 6 coats of shellac and set up in public places as a warning to others," Aunt Felicity sniffed. "Dogger, you may take my luggage up to my room."
But he had already done so.
"I hope they haven't put me in the same wing of the house as those communists," she muttered.
But they had. They'd given her the room next to Phyllis Wyvern's.
Aunt Felicity had no sooner stumped off to her quarters than Phyllis Wyvern herself strolled casually into the foyer, script in hand, mouthing words as if she were memorizing some particularly difficult lines.
"My dear vicar," she smiled as she spotted him lurking just inside the door, "how lovely to see you again."
"The pleasure belongs to Bishop's Lacey," the vicar said. "It is not often that our sequestered little village is honoured with a visitation of someone of, such stellar magnitude. I believe the first Queen Elizabeth in 1578 was the last such. There's a brass plaque in the church, you know."
It was easy to see that he'd said precisely the right thing. Phyllis Wyvern fairly purred as she replied,
"I've been giving some thought to your proposal," she said, leaving a long pause as if to suggest the vicar had asked her hand in marriage.
He went a little pink and smiled like a happy saint.
"And decided that sooner is better than later. Poor Val is facing a couple of unforeseen difficulties, an injured wrangler, a missing camera, and now, I'm told, a frozen generator. We're not likely to expose any film for a couple of days yet. I know, it's terribly short notice, but do you think you could arrange something for tomorrow?"
A shadow crossed the vicar's face.
"Dear me," he said, I shouldn't wish to seem ungrateful, but there are certain difficulties of a practical nature."
"Such as?"
she asked charmingly.
"Well, to be perfectly frank, the WC in the parish hall has gone for a Burton, which means, of course, that any public function is simply not on. Poor Dick Plews, our plumber, has been laid up with influenza for days now and not likely to be up and about for quite some time. The poor dear man's 82, you know, and though he's usually as chipper as a sparrow, this bitter cold,
perhaps one of our technical people could..."
"A most kind of you, I'm sure, but I'm afraid that's not the worst of it. Our furnace, too, has been baring its fangs. The monster in the basement, we call it. It's a Deacon and Bromwell, made in 1851 and shown at the Great Exhibition. A great steel octopus of a thing with the temperament of a scorpion. Dick has been having an affair of the heart with the brute since he was no more than a lad at his father's knee. He coddles it outrageously, but in recent years he's been reduced to casting replacement parts by hand, and, well, you see..."
I hadn't noticed him yet, but Father had come from his study and was standing quietly beside a pile of packing cases.
"Perhaps a solution is more closely at hand," he said, coming forward. "Miss Wyvern, welcome to Buckshaw. I'm Haviland Deluce."
"Colonel Deluce, what a pleasure to meet you at last. I've heard so much about you. I'm greatly indebted to you for so graciously opening your lovely home to us."
"Lovely home? Was she being facetious? I couldn't tell."
"Not at all," Father was saying. "We are all of us debtors in one way or another."
There was an uneasy silence.
"I, for instance," he went on, "am in the debt of my friend the vicar for fetching my sister and me from the train at Doddingsley, a most hazardous mission over treacherous roads brought to a happy conclusion by his remarkable driving skills."
The vicar muttered something about winter tires, augmented with snow chains, and then subsided to allow Father his time in the spotlight with Phyllis Wyvern. They were still holding hands, and Father was saying,
"Perhaps I may be allowed to offer the use of Buckshaw for your performance. It is, after all, only for an evening, and I'm sure it wouldn't infringe upon our agreement if the foyer were cleared and set up with chairs for a few hours."
"Splendid!" the vicar chimed in. "There's room enough here for every soul in Bishop's Lacey, man, woman, and child, with room left over for elbows. Come to think of it, it's even more spacious than the parish hall. How odd that I didn't think of it before. It's too late for posters and handbills, but I'll ask Cynthia to produce some tickets on the hectograph. But first things first, she'll need to get the ladies of the calling circle organized to ring round the village and sign everyone up."
"And I'll have a word with our director," Phyllis Wyvern said, letting go of Father's hand at last. "I'm sure it will be all right. Val can't say no to me in certain spheres, and I'll see to it that this is one of them."
She smiled charmingly, but I noticed that both Father and the vicar looked away.
"Good morning, Flavia," she said at last, but her acknowledgement of my presence came too late for my liking.
"Good morning, Miss Wyvern," I said, and walked off coolly towards the drawing-room with a kiss-my-Nelly look on my face. I'd show her a thing or two about acting. My eyes must have bugged out of their sockets. Dressed in the green silk she had worn when she played the part of Becky Sharp in the Dramatic Society's production of Vanity Fair, Feely was standing in front of a small round table, putting down a letter, picking it up, and putting it down again. She would do this most delicately, then with a jerk of hesitation, and then with a sudden thrust, as if she couldn't stand the sight of the thing. She was rehearsing her appearance, or at least the appearance of one of her hands, in Cry of the Raven. "I was chatting with Phyllis," I said casually, stretching the facts a little. "She and Desmond Duncan are doing a scene from Romeo and Juliet on Saturday night, here in the foyer, for charity."
"No one will come," Daffy said sourly. "In the first place, it's too close to Christmas. In the second, it's too short notice. In the third, in case they haven't thought of it, no one's going anywhere in this weather without snowshoes and a St. Bernard."
"Bet you're wrong," I said. "I'll bet you sixpence the whole village turns out."
"Done," Daffy said, spitting on her palm and shaking my hand.
It was the first physical contact I'd had with my sister since the day, months before, that she and Feely had trussed me up and dragged me into the cellars for a candlelight inquisition. I shrugged and walked to the door. A quick glance before leaving showed me that the hand of Becky Sharp was still mechanically picking up and putting down the letter like a clockwork wraith. Although there was something pathetic about her actions, I couldn't, for the life of me, think what it was. Halfway along the corridor, I became aware of angry voices in the foyer. Naturally, I stopped to listen. I am both blessed and cursed with Harriet's acute sense of hearing, an almost supernatural sensitivity to sound for which I have sometimes given thanks and sometimes despaired, never knowing until later which it was to be. I recognized at once that the voices were those of Val Lampman and Phyllis Wyvern.
"I don't give a tinker's damn what you've promised," he was saying. "You'll simply have to tell them that it's off."
"And look like a bloody fool. Think about it, Val. What's it going to cost? A couple of hours at a time of day when we're not working anyway. I'm doing it on my own time, and so is Desmond."
"That isn't the point. We're already behind schedule, and things are only going to get worse. Patrick, Bun, we've only been here a day. I simply don't have the resources to keep shoving shipping crates around so that you can do your Fairy Queen impression."
"You heartless brute," she said. Her voice was cold as ice.
Val Lampman laughed. "The Glass Heart, page 93, if I'm not mistaken. You never forget a line, do you, old girl?"
Incredibly, she laughed.
"Come on, Val, be a sport. Show them you've got more in your heart than meat."
"Sorry, old love," he said, No can do this time.
There was a silence, and I wished I could see their faces, but I couldn't move without giving away my presence.
Supposing, Phyllis Wyvern said in little more than a whisper, that I told Desmond about that interesting adventure of yours in Buckinghamshire.
You wouldn't dare, he hissed. Come off it, Phyllis. You wouldn't dare.
Would I not?
I could tell that she'd got on her high horse again.
Damn you, he said. Damn you and damn you and damn you.
There was another silence, even longer this time, and then Val Lampman suddenly said,
All right, then, you shall have your little show. It won't make much difference to my plans.
Thank you, Val.
I knew you'd come round to my way of thinking.
You always do.
Now, shall we go upstairs and join the others? They'll be getting impatient. I heard the sound of their footsteps going up the stairs. I'd give it a few more seconds, I thought, just to be certain they were gone. But before I could move, someone stepped out from the shadows into the middle of the corridor. Bun Keats! She had not seen me. Her back was turned, and she was peeking round the corner into the foyer. It was evident that she'd been eavesdropping on the conversation I just happened to overhear. If she turned round, she'd be almost face to face with me. I held my breath. After what seemed like an eternity, she walked slowly through into the foyer and vanished from sight. Again, I waited until I heard her footsteps fade away.
It's a pity, isn't it? A voice said, almost at my shoulder. When people don't get along.
I nearly jumped out of my skin. I spun round and there was Marion Trodd with a quizzical, or was it a rueful, half-smile on her face. In spite of her smart tailored suit, her dark horn-rimmed glasses gave her the look of a tribal princess who had rubbed ashes round her empty black eyes in preparation for a jungle sacrifice. She'd been there all along, and to think that I hadn't heard or seen her. The two of us stood motionless, staring at each other in the dim corridor, not knowing quite what to say.
"Excuse me," I said, "I've just remembered something." It was true. What I'd remembered was this. While I was not in the least afraid of the dead, there were those among the living who gave me the creeping hooly-goolies, and Marion Trodd was one of them. I turned and walked quickly away before something horrid could rise up out of the carpet and suck me down into the weave.
Chapter 7 Father was sitting at the kitchen table listening to Aunt Felicity. This, more than anything, brought home to me how much, and how rapidly, our little world had been shrunk. I slipped silently, or so I thought, into the pantry and helped myself to a piece of Christmas cake.
This has gone on long enough, Haviland. It's been 10 years now, and I've looked on in silence as your situation declined, hoping that you'd one day come to your senses.
This was laughably untrue. Aunt Felicity never missed an opportunity to dig in a critical oar.
But all in vain. It's unhealthy for the children to go on living under such barbaric conditions.
Children? Did she think of us as children?
The time has come, Haviland, she went on, to stop this incessant moping about and find yourself a wife, and preferably a rich one. It is positively indecent for a tribe of girls to be raised by a man. They become savages. It's a well-known fact that they don't develop properly. Lissy.
Flavia, you may step out, Aunt Felicity called, and I shuffled into the kitchen, a little shamefaced at having been caught snooping.
See what I mean, she said, darkly, pointing at me with a finger whose nail was the red of exhausted blood.
I was getting Dogger a piece of Christmas cake, I said, hoping to make her feel dreadful. He's been working so hard, and he often doesn't take enough to eat.
I took one of Dogger's black jackets from behind the door and threw it over my shoulders.
And now, if you'll excuse me, I said, and went out the kitchen door.
The cold air nipped at my cheeks and knees and knuckles as I trotted through the falling flakes. The narrow path that someone had shoveled was already beginning to fill in. Dogger, in overalls, was in the greenhouse, trimming sprigs of holly and mistletoe.
"Brr," I said, "it's cold."
Since he wasn't in the habit of responding to chit-chat, he said nothing. The Christmas tree Dogger had promised was nowhere in sight, but I fought down my disappointment. He probably hadn't had time.
"I've brought you some cake," I said, breaking off half and handing it to him.
"Thank you, Miss Flavia. The kettle is just coming to the boil. Will you join me for tea?"
Sure enough, on a potting bench at the back of the greenhouse, a battered tin kettle on a hot plate was shooting out excited jets of steam from lid and spout.
"Let's rouse Gladys," I said,
and as Dogger filled two refreshingly grubby teacups, I lifted my trusty bicycle from the corner where she had been stowed and carefully unwound the protective sacking in which, after a thorough oiling, Dogger had wrapped her for the winter.
"You're looking quite fit," I told her, making a little joke.
Gladys was a BSA keep fit that had once belonged to Harriet.
"Quite fit," Dogger said, "in spite of her hibernation."
I propped up Gladys on a kickstand beside us and gave her bell a couple of jangles. It was good to hear her cheery voice in winter. We sat in companionable silence for a while, and then I said,
"She's quite beautiful, isn't she, for her age?"
"Gladys? Or Miss Wyvern?"
"Well, both, but I meant Miss Wyvern," I said, happy that Dogger had made the leap with me. "Do you think Father will marry her?"
Dogger took a sip of tea, put down his cup, and picked up a sprig of mistletoe. He held it up by the stem as if weighing it, then put it down again.
"Not if he doesn't want to."
"I thought we weren't having decorations," I said.
"The director didn't want the trouble of removing them when they begin filming."
"Miss Wyvern has decided otherwise. She's asked me to provide a suitably sized Christmas tree in the foyer for her performance on Saturday night."
I felt my eyes widening.
"To remind her of the tree she had in childhood. She said that her parents always put up a tree."
"And she asked you for holly and mistletoe?"
"Yes, sir, yes, sir. 3 bags full, sir," Dogger smiled.
I hugged myself, and not just from the cold. Even the smallest of jokes on Dogger's lips warmed my heart, perhaps made me too bold.
"Did your parents," I asked, "used to put up a tree, I mean? The holly and the ivy and the mistletoe and all that?"
Dogger did not answer straight away. The faintest of shadows seemed to drift across his face.
"In that part of India in which I was a child," he said at last, "mistletoe and holly were not easily to be had. I believe I remember decorating a mango tree for Christmas."
"A mango tree? India? I didn't know you lived in India."
Dogger was silent for a long time.
"But that was long ago," he said at last, as if returning from a dream. "As you know, Miss Flavia, my memory is not what it once was."
"Never mind, Dogger," I said, patting his hand. "Neither is mine. Why, just yesterday I had a thimbleful of arsenic in my hand, and I put it down somewhere. I can't for the life of me think what I could have done with it."
"I found it in the butter dish," Dogger said. "I took the liberty of setting it out for the mice in the coach house."
"Butter and all?" I asked.
"Butter and all."
"But not the dish?"
"But not the dish," said Dogger.
"Why aren't there more people like Dogger in the world?"
Remembering Father's orders to keep out from underfoot, I spent what remained of the day in my laboratory, making last-minute adjustments to the consistency of my powerful bird lime. The addition of just the right amount of oil of petroleum would keep it from freezing. Christmas Eve was now just 48 hours away, and I needed to be ready for it. There would be no margin for error. I would have just one chance to capture Father Christmas, if, in fact, he existed. Why was I so mistrustful of my sister's tales of myth and folklore? Was it because experience had taught me that both of them were liars? Or was it because I really wanted, perhaps even needed, to believe. Well, Father Christmas or no, I would soon be writing up the great experiment in my notebook. Aim, hypothesis, method, results, discussion, conclusion. One way or another, it was bound to be a classic. Scribbled in the margin of one of Uncle Tar's notebooks, I had found a quotation from Sir Francis Bacon. We must not then add wings, but rather lead and ballast to the understanding, to prevent its jumping or flying. Precisely what I had in mind for St. Nicholas, a dose of the old tangle foot. Later, in bed, my head filled with visions of reindeer stuck fast to the chimney pots like giant blue bottles to flypaper. I realized I was grinning madly in the dark. Sleep came at last to what might have been the sounds of a distant gramophone. Chapter 8. I paused at the top of the stairs.
"It's not right," a voice was grumbling. "They've no right to lumber us with all this."
"Better keep it down, Latshaw," said another voice. "You know what Lampman told us?"
"Yes, I know what His Eminence said, same as he did on the last shoot, and the shoot before that. I've heard that beef speech of his enough times I can recite it in my sleep. If you've got a beef, tell it to me, and so on and so forth. Might as well tell it to the man in the moon for all the good it does."
"McNulty used to..."
"McNulty be damned! I'm in charge now, and what I say goes, and all I'm saying is this. They've got no right to lumber us with all this extra, just so that Her Royal Highness can give the local bumpkin something to gape at."
I backed slowly away from the staircase, then reapproached it more noisily.
"Shh! Someone's coming."
"Good morning," I said brightly,
rubbing my eyes and going into my best village idiot impersonation. If there'd been time, I'd have blacked out one of my front teeth with pulverized carbon.
"Good morning, miss,"
said the one, and I knew by his voice that the other was Latshaw.
"Snowy old morning, you what?"
I knew this was laying it on with a trowel, but with some people it doesn't matter. I had learned by personal experience that grumblers are deaf to any voices but their own.
"Oh, how pretty," I exclaimed as I reached the bottom of the stairs, clasping my hands together like a spinster who has just been given an engagement ring by a red-faced squire on bended knee.
The south side of the foyer had been transformed overnight into an Italian courtyard in evening. Stone walls painted onto canvas had been set up in front of the wood panelling, and the landing on the south staircase had become a balcony in Verona. A few artificial trees spotted here and there in pots skillfully disguised as little benches added greatly to the effect. The whole thing was so well done I could almost feel the warmth of the Italian sun. It was here, I knew, that in just a few hours Phyllis Wyvern and Desmond Duncan would be recreating the scene from Romeo and Juliet, a production that had once kept the West End of London awake until the small hours with curtain call after curtain call. I had read about it in the musty film and theatre magazines that were piled everywhere in Buckshaw's library, or at least had been until they were cleared away for purposes of filming.
"Best scamper, miss. The paint's still wet. You don't want to go getting it all over yourself, do you?"
"Not if it's lead-based," I shot back as I wandered casually away, recalling with a little shiver of pleasure the case of the American artist Whistler, who, while painting his famous The White Girl, because of the high content of lead white in the pigment in his prime colour, had contracted what artists called painter's colic. Would lead poisoning by any other name taste as sweet? I knew that rats had been known to gnaw through lead pipes because they had acquired a taste for the sweetness of the stuff. In fact, I had begun compiling notes for a pamphlet to be called Peculiarities of Plumism, and had turned to thinking pleasantly on that topic when the telephone rang. I went for it at once before it could ring a second time. If Father heard it, we were in for a day of wrath.
"Blast," I said as I picked the thing up.
"Hello, Flavia. Have I caught you at an inopportune time?" "Oh, hello, Vicar," I said. "Sorry, I just banged my knee on the door frame."
from Flavia's book of golden rules, when caught swearing, go for sympathy.
Poor girl, he said. I hope it's all right.
It will be fine, Vicar, when the agony abates.
Well, I'm just ringing up to let you know that everything at this end is going splendidly. Tickets nearly sold out and it's barely sunrise. Cynthia and her telephonic warriors outdid themselves last night.
Thank you, Vicar, I said. I'll let Father know.
Oh, and Flavia, tell him that Dieter Schrantz at Culverhouse Farm has suggested, if your father's willing, of course, that we use the old sleigh from your coach house to shuttle our theatre-goers from the parish hall to Buckshaw. He says he'll rig up a hitch that will allow him to tow it along behind the tractor. The ride itself should be worth the price of admission, don't you think?
Father had agreed with surprisingly little grumbling, but then, where the vicar was concerned, he nearly always did. There was a friendship between them of a deep and abiding power which I didn't really understand. Although they had both attended Grayminster, they had not been at the school in the same years, so that wouldn't explain it. The vicar had no more than a polite interest in postage stamps, and Father had no more than a passing interest in heaven, so the bond between them remained a puzzle. To be perfectly frank, I was a little envious of their easy chumminess, and I sometimes caught myself wishing that I were as great friends with my father as the vicar was. It wasn't that I hadn't tried. Once, while using one of his philatelic magazines to fan the flame of a sluggish Bunsen burner, the pages had riffled open and the words nascent oxygen had caught my eye. The stuff, it seemed, had been produced by adding formaldehyde to potassium permanganate and had been used by the post office to fumigate mailbags in the Mediterranean in the days when cholera was a constant threat. Now here was a fact about stamp collecting that was actually interesting. A bridge, however precarious it might seem, between my father's world and mine.
If you ever need any of your stamps disinfected, I had burst out, I'd be happy to do them for you. I could whip up some nascent oxygen in a jiff. It would be no trouble at all.
Like a time traveller who had just awakened to find himself in a strange household in an unexpected century, Father had looked up at me from his albums.
Thank you, Flavia, he had said after an unnerving pause. I shall keep it in mind.
Daffy, as always, was draped over a chair in the library with Bleak House open on her knees.
Don't you ever get tired of that book? I asked.
Certainly not, she snapped. It's so like my own dismal life that I can't tell the difference between reading and not reading.
Then why bother? I asked.
Bug off, she said. Go haunt someone else.
I decided to try a different approach.
You've got black bags under your eyes, I said. Were you reading late last night? Or does your conscience keep you awake over the despicable way you treat your little sister?
Despicable was a word I'd been dying to use in a sentence ever since I'd heard Cynthia Richardson, the vicar's wife, fling it at Miss Cool, the village postmistress, in reference to the Royal Mail.
Sucks to you, Daffy said. Who could sleep with all that caterwauling going on?
I didn't hear any caterwauling.
That's because your so-called supersensitive hearing has blown a fuse. You're probably beginning to display the hereditary delusive deafness. It skips from youngest daughter to youngest daughter and generally sets in before the age of 12.
Piffle, I said.
There was no caterwauling. It was all in your head.
Daffy's left earlobe began twitching as it does when she's upset. I could see that I had hit a nerve.
It's not in my head, she shouted, throwing down her book and jumping to her feet. It's that damned Wyvern woman. She runs old films all night, over and over, until you could scream. If I have to listen to that voice of hers saying, I shall never forget Torkover Castle, one more time as that cheesy music swells up, I'm going to vomit swamp water.
I thought you liked her, those magazines.
Curses. I'd almost given myself away. I wasn't supposed to know about what was in Daffy's bottom drawer. but I needn't have worried. She was too agitated to spot my slip-up.
I like her on paper, but not in person. She stares at me as if I'm some kind of freak.
Perhaps you are, I offered helpfully.
Get stuffed, she said. Since you're such great pals with Lady Phyllis, you can tell her next time you see her to keep the noise down. Tell her Buckshaw's not some slimy cinema in Slough, or wherever it is she comes from.
I'll do that, I said, turning on my heel and walking out of the room. For some odd reason, I was beginning to feel sorry for Phyllis Wyvern. In the foyer, Dogger was atop a tall orchard ladder, hanging a branch of holly from one of the archways.
"Mind the alyssum," I called up to him. "Don't lick your fingers."
It was a joke, of course. There was once thought to be enough of the glycoside in a couple of handfuls of the red berries to be fatal, but handling the leaves was actually as safe as houses. Dogger raised an elbow and looked down at me through the crook of his arm.
"Thank you, Miss Flavia," he said. "I shall be most careful."
Although it is pleasant to think about poison at any season, there is something special about Christmas, and I found myself grinning. That's what I was doing when the doorbell rang.
"I'll get it," I said.
A gust of snow blew into my face as I opened the door. I wiped my eyes, and only partly in disbelief, for there in the forecourt stood the Coatsmore bus, tendrils of steam rising ominously from its radiator cap. Its driver, Ernie, stood before me, digging at his dentures with a brass toothpick.
Step down, mind your feet, he called back over his shoulder to the column of people who were climbing down from the bus's open door. Your actors, he said, have arrived.
They came trooping past him and into the foyer like tourists flocking into the National Gallery at opening time. There must have been about 30 in all. Coats, scarves, galoshes, hand luggage, and gaily wrapped parcels. They were going to be here, I remembered, for Christmas. One last straggler was having difficulty with the steps. Ernie made a move to help her, but she brushed away his offered arm.
I can manage, she said brusquely. That voice! Nia! And indeed it was.
Nia Guilfoyle had been the assistant to Rupert Pawson, the travelling puppeteer who had come to a rather grisly end in St. Tancred's Parish Hall. I hadn't seen her since the summer, when she had gone off from Bishop's Lacey in something of a huff. But all of that seemed to have been forgotten. Here she was, on the front steps of Buckshaw, in a green coat and a joyful hat trimmed with red berries.
"Come on, then, give me a hug," she said, opening her arms wide. "You smell like Christmas," I said, noticing for the first time the large protuberance that stood between us.
8 months," she said, taking a step back and throwing open her winter coat.
"Have a gander."
"A gander at Mother Goose?"
I asked, and she laughed appreciatively. Nia had played the part of Mother Goose in the late Rupert's puppet show, and I hoped my little joke would not stir up unhappy memories.
"Mother Goose no more," she said. "Just plain old Nia Guilfoyle, miss. Jobbing actress, comedy, tragedy, pantomime. Apply Withers Agency, London. Telegraph, Wit Hag."
"But the puppet show?"
"Sold up," she said. "Lock, stock and barrel, to a lovely chap from Bournemouth. Fetched me enough to rent a flat, where Junior here can have a roof over his or her head, as the case may be, come January, when he or she finally decides to make his or her grand entrance."
"And you're starring in this?"
I asked, waving my hand to take in the theatrical hubbub in the foyer.
"Hardly starring. I've undertaken the less than demanding role of Anthea Flighting, pregnant daughter, in a nice way, of course, of Boaz Hazelwood. That's Desmond Duncan."
"I thought he was a bachelor. Doesn't he court Phyllis Wyvern?"
"He is, and he does, but he has a past."
"Ah," I said, "I see," although I didn't.
"Let me look at you," she said, grasping my shoulders and retracting her head. "You've grown, and you've got a little colour in your cheeks."
It's the cold, I said.
Speaking of which, she said with a laugh, let's go inside before the acorn on my belly button freezes and falls off.
Miss Nia, Dogger said as I closed the door behind us, it's a pleasure to have you back at Buckshaw.
Thank you, Dogger, she said, taking his hand. I've never forgotten your kindness.
The little one will be along soon, he said, in January.
Spot on, Dogger. You've got a good eye.
January 25th, according to my panel doctor. He said it wouldn't hurt me to sign on for this lark, as long as I gave up the ciggies, got plenty of sleep, ate well, and kept my feet up whenever I'm not actually in front of the camera.
She gave me a wink.
Very good advice, Dogger said. Very good advice indeed. I hope you were comfortable on the bus.
Well, it is a bit of a jolter, but it was the only transportation Ilium Films could lay on to get us from the station in Doddingsley. Thank God the thing's such a hulking old bulldog. It managed to hang on to the roads in spite of the snow.
By now, Marion Trod had shepherded the others away to the upper levels, leaving the foyer empty except for the three of us.
I'll show you to your room, Dogger said.
And Nia gave me a happy twiddle of the fingers, like Laurel and Hardy, as he led her away.
They had barely disappeared up the staircase when the doorbell rang again. Suffering cyanide! Was I to spend the rest of my life as a doorkeeper?
Another gust of frozen flakes and cold air.
Dieter!
Hello, Flavia. I have brought some chairs from the vicar.
Dieter Schrantz, tall, blonde and handsome, as they say on the wireless, stood on the doorstep, smiling at me with his perfect teeth.
Dieter's sudden appearance was a bit disconcerting. It was somewhat like having the god Thor deliver the furniture in person. As a devotee of English literature, especially the Bronte sisters, Dieter had elected to stay in England after his release as a prisoner of war, hoping someday to teach Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre to English students. He also had hopes, I think, of marrying my sister Feely.
Behind him, in the forecourt, the Coatsmore bus had now been replaced by a grey Ferguson tractor, which stood putt-putting quietly in the snow. Behind it a flat trailer piled high with folding chairs, which were covered almost entirely with a tarpaulin.
I'll hold the door for you, I offered. Are you coming to the play tonight?
Of course, Dieter grinned. Your William Shakespeare is almost as great a writer as Emily Bronte.
Get away with you, I said. You're pulling my leg.
It was a phrase Mrs. Mullet used. I never thought I'd find myself borrowing it. Load after load, five or six at a time, Dieter lugged the chairs into the house until at last they were set up in rows in the foyer, all of them facing the improvised stage.
Come into the kitchen and have some of Mrs. Mullet's famous cocoa, I said. She floats little islands of whipped cream in it, with rosemary sprigs slit for trees.
Thank you, but no, I'd better get back. Gordon doesn't like it if I...
I'll tell Feely you're here.
A broad grin spread across Dieter's face.
Very well, then, he said, but just one whipped cream island and no more.
Feely! I hollered towards the drawing room. Dieter's here.
No point wasting precious shoe leather. Besides, Feely had legs of her own.
Chapter 9
Well, 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 Mrs. Mullet said. And how's everything at Culver House Farm?
Very quiet, Dieter told her. It is perhaps the time of year.
Yes, she said. Although each of us knew there was more to it than that.
It would be a grim old Christmas at the Inglebys after the events of last summer.
And Mrs. Ingleby?
As well as can be expected, I believe, Dieter said.
I promised Dieter a cup of cocoa, I said. I hope it won't be too much trouble.
Cocoa's my speciality, Mrs. Mullet said. As you very well knows, cocoa is never too much trouble in any household what's run as it ought to be.
Better make three cups, I said. Feely will be here in 6, 5, 4, 3.
My ears had already picked up the sound of her hurrying footsteps.
Hurrying? She was flat out at the gallop.
two, one. An instant later, the kitchen door was edged open and Feely sidled casually into the room.
Oh, she said, widening her eyes in surprise.
Oh, Dieter, I didn't know you were here.
Hog's britches, she didn't. I could see through her like window glass.
But Feely's eyes were as nothing compared with Dieter's. He fairly gaped at her green silk get-up.
Ophelia, he said. For a moment I thought that you were...
Emily Bronte,
she said, delighted.
Yes, I knew you would.
If she didn't know he was here, I thought, how could she know he'd mistake her for his beloved Emily?
But Dieter, love-struck, didn't notice. I had to admire my sister Feely. She was as slick as a greased pig. Although I know it is scientifically impossible, it seemed as if Mrs. Mullet could boil milk faster than anyone on the planet. With the agar cooker already as hot as an alchemist's furnace, and by stirring constantly, she was able, in the blink of an eye, to conjure up steaming cups of cocoa, each with its own tropical island and mock palm tree.
"It's too hot in here,"
Feely whispered to Dieter, as if she could keep me from overhearing.
"Let's go into the drawing room."
As I moved to tag along, she shot me a look that said clearly,
"And if you dare follow us, you're a dead duck."
Naturally, I waddled along behind. Quack, I thought.
"Did you celebrate Christmas in Germany?" I asked Dieter. "Before the war, I mean."
"Of course," he said. "Father Christmas was born in Germany. Didn't you know that?"
"I did," I said, "but I must have forgotten."
"Weihnachten, we call it. Saint Nicholas, the lighted Christmas tree. Saint Nicholas brings sweets for the children on the 6th of December, and Weihnachtsmann brings gifts for everyone on Christmas Eve." He said this looking teasingly at Feely, who was sneaking a peek at herself in the looking glass.
"Two Father Christmases?" I asked.
"Something like that."
I gave an inward sigh of relief. Even if I did manage to bring one of them down and keep him from his rounds, there was still a spare to carry out whatever was left of the long night's work, at least in Germany.
Feely had drifted to the piano and settled onto the bench like a migrating butterfly. She touched the keys tentatively, without pressing down, as if playing the wrong combination would make the world explode.
"I'd better be getting back," Dieter said, draining his cup to the dregs.
"Oh, can't you stay?" Feely said. "I'd been hoping you'd translate some of the annotations on my facsimile edition of Bach's The Well-Tempered Clavier." "They should call it the bad-tempered clavier when you play it," I said. "She swears like stink when she hits a clinker," I explained to Dieter.
Feely went as red as the carpet. She didn't dare swap me in front of company. With her flushed face and her green outfit, she reminded me of something I'd seen in a recent color supplement. What was it now?
"Oh, yes, that was it. You look like the flag of Portugal," I said. "I'll leave you alone so that you can wave goodbye."
I knew that I would pay for my insolence later, but Dieter's hearty laugh was worth it. The house, generally so cold and silent, had suddenly become a beehive. Carpenters hammered, painters painted, and various people looked at various parts of the foyer through makeshift frames formed by touching thumbs and extending their fingers. An astonishing number of lights had been put into place, some hanging from clamps on skeletal scaffolding and others mounted on spindly floor stands, black wires and cables twisted everywhere. Wig-wagging my extended arms for balance, I navigated my way carefully across the room, pretending I was walking across a pit of sleeping snakes. Poisonous snakes that could awaken at any moment and...
"Hoi! Flavia!"
I looked up to see the ruddy face of Gil Crawford, the village electrician, grinning down at me through the framework of a high scaffold that had been rigged to span the great front door. Gil had been of much assistance in bringing back to life some of the more Frankensteinian of the electrical devices in Uncle Tar's laboratory,
and had even taken the time to drill me in the safe handling of certain of the high-voltage instruments. "Always remember," he had taught me to recite, "brown wire to the live, blue to the neutral, greenery yallery to the propensity, so's you don't wake up in eternity." When it came to wires and eternity, Gil was said to be something of an expert. "He was a commando during the war," Mrs. Mallet had once whispered while gutting a rabbit on the kitchen table. "They was taught how to give up people with a bit of piano wire round their necks. Thack!" She'd grimaced horribly, her eyes rolled up, her tongue lolling at the side of her mouth by way of illustration. "Quick as a wink," Alf says. "Next minute, the victim finds himself sitting on a cloud with an harp in his hand and wondering where in heaven's name the world's ever got to." "Mr. Crawford," I called up to Gil, "what are you doing here?" "Keeping the old hand in," he shouted back above the din of the hammering. I put one foot on the ladder at the scaffold side and began, hand over hand, to haul myself up. At the top, I stepped off onto the broad planks that formed a makeshift floor. "Used to work this film lark when I was an apprentice lad," he grinned rather proudly. "Keep my dues up, just in case. You never know nowadays, do you?" "How's Mrs. Crawford?" I asked. His wife, Martha, had recently invited me for tea while she ferreted out, from a box of cast-off valves, an obsolete rectifier for a radio-frequency fluorescing tube, for which she would take not a penny. It was a debt which I had so far been unable to repay. "Topping," he said, "fair topping. She's minding the shop so's I can come out on this caper." He worked as he spoke, fastening a second long-snouted spotlight to a tubular cross member with a couple of clamps. "Busiest time of year it is, too. Sold 6 wireless sets and 3 gramophones this week alone. So she did. A 4-slice toaster and an electric egg cozy. Fancy."
"You must have a lovely view of things from up here," I observed.
"So I do," he said, tightening the last bolt. "Funny you should say so. It's the same thing that German fellow from Culver House told me as he left. Far from the madding crowd, he called up to me. Talks over my head, but he's a good lad for all that."
"Yes, his name is Dieter," I told him. "He meant Thomas Hardy."
Gil scratched his head. "Hardy? Don't know him. From around here, is he?"
"He's an author."
Like any bookworm's sister, I knew the titles of a million books I hadn't read. "Ah," he said, as if that settled it. "You better scramble down now. If the chief sees you up here, both our gooses will be cooked."
"Geese," I said. "Latshaw, you mean?"
"Yes, that's right," he said quietly. "Geese," and turned his attention to a box of coloured filters. I had nearly reached the bottom of the ladder when I became aware of a face too close for comfort. I jumped to the floor and twisted round to find myself standing almost on Latshaw's toes.
"Who told you could go up there?" he asked, his ginger moustache bristling.
"No one," I said. "I was having a word with Mr. Crawford."
"Mr. Crawford is on time and a half for a short call in the holiday season," he said. "He has no time for idle chit-chat, do you, Mr. Crawford?"
This last part he called out loudly enough for everyone to hear. I stepped back and glanced up at Gil, who was fussing with his spotlight, but he must have heard.
"I'm sorry," I said,
becoming aware of the sudden silence that had fallen upon the foyer.
"Take my advice, miss," Latshaw said, "and keep to your quarters. We've no time for nuisances."
In my mind, Latshaw was already writhing on the floor, his face engorged, his eyes bulging from their socket, hanging on with both hands to his gut, begging for the antidote to cyanide poisoning.
"Help me! Just help me!" he was screaming. "I'll do anything, anything!"
"Very well, then," I was telling him, reluctantly handing over a beaker into which I had stirred carefully calibrated proportions of ferrous sulfate, caustic potash, and powdered oxide of magnesium. "But in future, you really must learn how properly to address your betters."
Perhaps Latshaw was a mind reader. Perhaps not. But he turned, strode off abruptly, and began giving right old hob to a carpenter who wasn't driving a nail properly. At that very instant, a blood-curdling shriek came echoing from somewhere in the upper regions of the house.
"No! No! Let me alone!"
I recognized it at once. All eyes were turned upwards as I flew past the workers and up the stairs. At the landing, one of the actresses reached out to stop me, but I shook her off and continued my flight to the top and along the first-floor corridors, my pounding feet the only sound in the eerie silence that had fallen suddenly upon the house.